Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen. Today, I'm welcomed by a good friend and co-host, Scott Soares. Hey, Scott, how you doing?
Doing well, Aaron. Great to be here.
Scott, you made the long trip in from Western Massachusetts to partake in today's conversation.
I did. Yeah, it's all about 2 hours for me now, although most of my work has been more on the marine side. So fortunately, I don't mind the drive back and forth to the eastern part of the state.
Yeah.
But it's great to be here.
You're putting on some miles.
I am. And traffic, fortunately, was not that bad coming into Boston.
We timed it nicely. Perfect.
That's right.
Scott, let me read a little bit about your background, and then we'll jump into the conversation. Scott Soares is the former Commissioner of Agriculture in Massachusetts and served as the Director of USDA Rural Development for Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island for the Obama administration. Scott has 15 years of fishery and aquaculture experience prior to that, including early in his career serving as the first Massachusetts coordinator of aquaculture for nearly a decade. Scott has long since been dedicated to improving the lives of fishermen and farmers through facilitating economic and environmental adaptation. From creating agricultural support programs and services to adapting laws and regulations to be more producer-friendly, to administering international and domestic market development for U.S. producers, Soares has well-earned credibility in aquaculture and terrestrial food producer industries. Scott is now the founding principal of Hingeline and a trusted voice for seafood producers and industry up and down the East Coast. Scott, how are you? There it is.
Thanks, Aaron. Very, very nice.
Hey,
thank you.
I've joked the fact I try to get those all in one breath.
Yeah, no, our time's up now, right?
That's it. Hope you enjoyed the conversation. That was exciting stuff. Hey, Scott, check this out. I was doing some reading and found out that down in Baltimore, as part of a continuing improvement to its 24-acre Locust Point campus, Domino's Sugar refined sugar program, just installed an oyster garden off its piers. How about that? Who would have thunk? Isn't that right? Yes. They installed a total of 50 wire mesh cages built by Domino Sugar employees on Earth Day. And it would be filled with dozens of baby oysters, which the industry term is spat, and lowered into the water beneath one of the facility's piers. The oysters will grow in protection for several months in the water. And periodically, volunteers from Domino will clean the cages in order to allow for free flow of water and plankton to reach the oysters so they can grow faster. Okay. Mm. Next summer, once the oysters have grown large enough and survive outside their cages, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation will collect the oysters and place them in a sanctuary reef near Key Bridge. I'm less familiar with Baltimore, but it sounds like a unique location down there on these piers that they're doing this in. And obviously to get the Chesapeake Bay Foundation involved, they're doing something right, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. Right? So the current oyster population is estimated to be at a small fraction of its original levels. That's according to the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. So the article showed numerous different photos, signposts from ARG Group, which is the parent company of Domino Sugar, promoting their eco-friendly oyster garden to the community, basically running up and down the waterfront at this vast sugar refinery. So how about that? We got ocean health through oysters. It's become so prevalent and exciting that big refined sugar companies are taking part in the cleanup and gathering it up as PR along the way. So I'm not sure what to say about this, to be honest. And part of me is encouraged and inspired that big organizations, ones that we wouldn't have thunk would have been down this path. But other fears come to greenwashing and kind of marketing fluff, right? Mm. I wonder if Fluff is a customer of Domino. Huh? How about that? Yeah, maybe. Maybe they need oysters too, right? I don't know. But it brings me back to like what Big Soda is doing, fighting for nutritional values and kind of trying to promote their products in different ways. Somewhat disingenuous, it seems. But again, I don't want to cast that across the bow of these groups, because even though they may be causing obesity and diabetes at vast levels in this country, maybe they do care about ocean health. And maybe this is something that we can all congeal or work together on. then again, it's who knows? It's a catch-22. What do you think of that, yeah. Scott?
Well, and I think it's also indicative of a shift as we see aquaculture and specifically shellfish aquaculture becoming more popular. Folks like myself and others who have been around the industry for several decades, they recognize that it's much more than just producing the product, that it's absolutely producing product that also has environmental and economic benefit at the same time, which is pretty unique. The other thing that I think is indicative of what you see with like Domino as an example of a big agro corporation, that it is still agriculture. And one of the first catchphrases that we actually used going back to 1997 when we first started talking about the growth of aquaculture here in Massachusetts that actually had begun decades earlier, it was all about, just adding water, that aquaculture was agriculture. And I think what's happened is more and more folks, consumers and other agribusinesses, are starting to catch on to the fact that it is agriculture. It is controlled cultivation in many ways, but it's also a way to generate some great high-quality protein product that, again, has an environmental benefit at the same time.
Yeah, and maybe, looking at this and saying, if you have these sugar-induced oysters going at it, if they're pumping Domino byproduct through there, I think the stat is that an average large or adult oyster can process 50 gallons of water. Maybe on a sugar high, they can do 100 gallons a day. Who knows?
Well, let's hope the sugar nuts get into the water there.
That's right. Well, who knows? Well, that cues us up for our conversation today. Today, we have the opportunity of welcoming a tremendous guest with unique knowledge in this space, Bill Mook, who's the founder and CEO of Mook Sea Farm. Hey, Bill, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Hey, all right. Thanks for taking the time. I know you got a busy day, so we welcome the opportunity to learn more about what you're up to and some of the large-scale programs you're working on stabilizing the planet, cleaning our oceans. So, Bill, let me do this. I'm going to jump in by reading a quick introduction, and then we'll start with the questions.
Sure.
Okay, so Mook Sea Farm is an oyster farm founded in 1985 on the Damariscotta River in mid-coast Maine. He's near the rear American oysters from egg to adult size. Your hatchery produces 80 to 100 million juvenile oysters, seeds, annually for sale, and two other oyster growers throughout the Mid-Atlantic and the Northeast. And for your cultivation in Wiley Point and Pemaquid Point oysters for a half-shell market. So, Bill, if you could expand upon that for our first question and tell us, how'd you get into oysters in the first place and what's happened over the last 30 years?
Well, I came to Maine back in 1978 as a newlywed and to go to graduate school at the University of Maine's Department of Oceanography, which is in Walpole, just a short distance from where I'm sitting on the Damariscotta River. And while I was a graduate student there, I was hired by a hatchery called Bristol Shellfish, which is on the other side of the peninsula from the Damariscotta River on Muscungus Bay. And I was doing basic labor to earn money while I was writing a thesis. And one day the owner walked in and fired all the people who were running the facility. And on the way out the door, as I was cleaning tanks, handed me his business card and said, "Here, you're in charge now." So that is a true story.
Wow.
And so I ran that facility for a couple years and brought it to kind of a break-even point. In those days, the seed market wasn't very big. It was a huge facility. It had been a shrimp processing plant back in the 60s. And so after, I think it was about just before 1985, he decided to sell the land for condominiums. I was able to take a bunch of the equipment out of there, some of which is still in service. And I started my own business on the Damariscotta River, and that was in 1985, and the rest is history.
So you must have had that tank looking pretty sharp and clean, I would say, if he gave you the job right from that. That was quite impressive.
It was spick and span.
It was spick and span. Can't get better than that.
Right.
That's right. Always put the extra elbow grease. There's a lesson out of this conversation, no doubt about that. Hey, Bill, Scott and I came up maybe a year and a half ago at this point, and we saw that you're in the midst of a pretty large-scale build-out of a new program. And in my intro, I said that you're about 100 million juvenile oysters a year. But I think I remember a number that we talked about, that with your new scale, your new growth, you're looking to be around a half a billion seeds. Am I misremembering that?
Actually, that's not, I don't think we've ever really targeted a number like that. I will say that our seed production out of our hatchery is up over $140 million, and whether we decide to do a lot more or we actually just grow this, the, you know, a similar number to a bigger size, we're sort of in the process of trying to figure that out. But since you were here, we did complete the construction of a new facility, which is about 9,000 square feet. It's a multi-purpose facility, some of which will be used to grow and expand our microalgae production. Microalgae are single-celled plants that we grow. The phytoplankton is another name for them. And we grow microalgae to feed all the different life stages that we rear in the hatchery, you know, in that hatchery process. So that's part of the purpose of the new building. We also expanded our packing and shipping area, and then a big part of the building is devoted to a series of recirculating tanks. Each tank is 26,000 gallons, and they're 50 feet long by 10 feet wide and 8 feet deep, and they hold a series of stacked bins above them on the concrete floor that can be forklifted into place. And it gives us the potential for a great deal of resiliency in the face of a lot of the environmental changes that we're facing.
Really interesting. Bill, I wanted to pick up on something you said when the business had transitioned and the previous owner, before you set up your current business, had sold the land for condominiums. And it struck me when you said that it's much like I was saying in my opening comments about the common threads between land-based agriculture and water-based agriculture or aquaculture, that they often say on the land side that the last crop a farmer will ever plant is a house. And it sounds like the same has been true on the coastal community side, that the last crop those folks will ever plant are condominiums, that once that's done, it's really limiting the access for the kinds of working waterfronts that that you're engaged in right now with the aquaculture side.
I think that's very true. And that was, I will say it was a fairly exposed site, but it did have commercial value, but at that time, converting it into residential space seemed to be, for him, the best option. Mm-hmm. And it also, I have to say, gave me the opportunity to start my own business. So I'm not complaining too much, but yeah. You're right.
Got it. In relative to access, and again, the comparisons between land-based and water-based agriculture, our aquaculture, the access to the bottom, it's a bit different in the ownership issues. And I'm wondering if you can comment at all on that, on when you start to look at, you know, actually ownership of the fields, where oftentimes on the land side, land is one of the most valuable assets of those farming operations. And I think at this point now, 20, 30 or more years, for folks like yourself down the road, when you look at access to that water base and the water quality around those issues, how important that is as an integrated part of your business. How that is impacting what you do and what you think you'll be able to do moving forward on access to water and water rights in the bottom.
So for us, we have a land base and with access to the water. We have a good sized pier, so we were able to secure that pretty early on when we started the business. However, I do think that, depending on how real estate values increase, it does become more and more difficult to gain that commercial access to the water. And you know, that's really, the one thing about shellfish aquaculture is that it's a very, high yield operation. In other words, the dollar value per acre is probably a lot higher than most agricultural operations. And so those leases are very valuable, but like you say, it's not something that you can actually own, at least here in Maine. All of our sites where we grow the oysters are leased from the state of Maine, and there's a very involved process that you go through to do that. But I think going forward, that is something that's becoming more difficult. It's always been somewhat difficult because people who are shorefront owners oftentimes don't really want to look at oyster operations out in front of their houses, and feel that there's a sense of entitlement to the view when they buy their expensive real estate. I guess from an oyster farmer's perspective, having been on the Damariscotta River for 34 years coming up on, you know, the other perspective is that as we work out in the water, our beautiful scenery of the shore has changed pretty dramatically.
Interesting. Yeah.
Bill, in picking up on that thread, one thing I would say, a great unifier amongst all New England states is we're adverse to change, especially in our beautiful coastal environments. But I think it seems the realization is happening that change is happening, and we can be part of that solution. Has that message resonated with people that own these parcels, these properties, and the high rent districts? And are we seeing the NIMBY crowd being more understanding and appreciative of shellfish aquaculture?
I actually believe that there is more understanding of it. And I think as people realize that we have a pretty substantial food crisis looming over our heads, and that, you know, these are jobs that are being created in our local economy here, that, you know, there are not very many industries that can make the claim that by putting more of what they're growing out in the water, you're actually improving the environment. And so I think with the big environmental changes we're facing, and with more education and people talking about the environmental benefits of shellfish farming, I do think that a lot of those people are sort of coming around and seeing the value of it. You know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, for sure, because we have a lot of people who surround our leases who actually really like seeing the activity. So a lot of times people talk about how, well, if you have an oyster farm in front of your house, it's going to lower the property value. That may be true for those current owners, but in terms of being able to resell it, not necessarily so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. It's and I'm wondering, Bill, it's given, you know, from my experience anyway, going back a couple of decades, I know we couldn't say the word aquaculture in some of the communities back when, you know, a first tranche of pretty strict regulations came into place that were limiting what offshore fishing folks could do. And I'm sure the industry has changed. I know it's changed quite a bit here in Massachusetts, but I'm curious if you can comment on how it's changed. And I think part of that change, getting to educating the public within your own community, how it's grown, and just to put it into context of where you were and where the industry was back, you know, 30 years ago versus where it is now on scale in Maine.
Yeah, it was very small when I started, and pretty much all of the oyster farming in Maine was located right here on the Damariscotta River with a small handful of farms. And it's really been exciting to have a career in this business where, essentially from, I would say, the late 1990s through the present, we've just seen this steady growth in oyster farming. And it truly is a renaissance. And then another thing, kind of going back, touching on what we were just talking about a little bit, I think one of the other things that's changing, and I think it's an opportunity that aquaculture creates for people in traditional fisheries that are experiencing, you know, problems. So right now, we're seeing a lot of people from the lobster industry hedging their bets and getting into aquaculture. Some of them are farming and testing out new ways to grow sea scallops. Some of them are farming oysters. I think there's some farming quahog clams here in Maine. So we're seeing a lot of growth, a lot of new farms coming online, and it's a very exciting time to be doing this.
Scott, what are you seeing in Massachusetts? I mean, we have a little more of a higher density of population down here, maybe a little more of a louder voice for certain people. And we also have our fisheries, which are uber stressed and overstressed, New Bedford being a good example. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing that same perspective of an alternative revenue stream of looking at farming versus fishing?
Yeah, absolutely. And to put it into a little bit of context, one of the towns when I referenced, you couldn't say the words aquaculture in places like New Bedford. And not to diss Maine at all, Bill, but at New Bedford, it's still the number one fishing port, you know, by value, primarily due to the scallop fleet in the country. But now they are even looking at aquaculture as an opportunity, not only for folks in watermen, baymen, you know, commercial fishermen, but also for, and I think importantly, for that waterfront infrastructure, for all of those, you know, processing facilities, for all of the distribution networks and channels that they have that they can rely on to basically get the great product that we have, not only in Massachusetts, but I think throughout New England, and get that product elsewhere where food quality issues, food safety issues are really important, that we have a real marketing advantage to those products here that others don't have in different countries around the world.
Bill, I want to definitely spend ample time on talking about the environmental impact, positive environmental impact, net positive impact that oysters have. But I want to ask a question prior to that, and this is stemming off of Scott's point here. Scott and I have had a lot of opportunity of going up and down the East Coast and looking at different shellfish producers. And without a doubt, we get a very common theme that if you want to know what's going on with research and development and bleeding edge technologies, go talk to Bill Mook. And, you know, what I've seen or remember from our visit and then also doing additional research, your hatchery or your new hatchery is going to be second to none. Innovations include the development and methods of intertwining seed out of the water. You have tidal-powered nursery systems, a vessel and gear mechanism to use, which your patented oyster grow cages, and unique energy efficiency. And really the one that I'd love to hear more about, and if you could chat about this with our listening audience, is in your production system, the microalgae approach, the development of your microalgae approach for the food in your hatchery, which is, from my understanding, a bit like brewing microalgae versus a traditional method of growing it. Am I understanding that properly?
You are absolutely correct. It is a fermentation process, and the way I look at it is if all of this aquaculture stuff doesn't pan out, I'm just going to start making beer.
Not a bad fallback, Bill.
Right. But so traditional shellfish hatcheries use photosynthesis to grow their microalgae. And especially at the higher latitudes, that means that you have to generate a lot of artificial light. The problem with that is, and just a little review on photosynthesis, is that you're using light energy. The cells that you're growing are using that light energy to take carbon dioxide out of the water and build it into carbohydrates and then use that to make all the other things they need to make more cells. The problem is that energy has to come through the surface area of the container. What fermentation technology does is it allows you to bypass that and feed the cells sugar directly, simple sugar. And so now you have both the energy, because the sugar molecules are high energy, and the building blocks to make more cells completely throughout the medium. And it's a very efficient process. It means that we don't have to generate electric light. We do have a little bit of light in the room because we need to be able to see when we go in and work on the cultures. It's not just the energy that it costs to make the light. It's almost more of a problem getting rid of the heat that those lights create. So this fermentation process is a really efficient way to grow a lot of cells in a very small footprint, and with a lot less energy costs going into it. And so what this provides is the opportunity to essentially decouple the growing of the food from the husbandry of the animals. And that's something that has not happened really to any great extent in shellfish aquaculture.
Yeah, so real sea change.
It's a big sea change. And actually what we're looking at is not only growing microalgae in this new facility for ourselves to use in the hatchery and to use in those tanks I was describing a bit earlier, and probably we'll get into that with some of the environmental change stuff, but also to create a product that we can sell as another revenue stream. Oh. And so, for example, other hatcheries, whether you know they're in Massachusetts or Virginia or wherever else, can buy this concentrated preserved food that we would be selling.
Remarkable. A shelf-stable shellfish food.
Right.
Yeah, it's remarkable. So, and for folks who don't know the industry like we do, the reality is for facilities like yours, you're engaged in not only growing the shellfish, but you're growing that whole food source for them as well, which
Correct.
Is like two different agricultural businesses altogether that you're growing those separately. So one definitely depends on the other, especially as you get more vertically integrated.
And the microalgae part of it is sort of, that's really the high tech part of it, because all of the microalgae is grown in a clean room where all the air is pumped in. It's maintained under positive air pressure. All the air is highly filtered. And to go in there, you have to gown up and put on a Tyvek suit with gloves and all that. So it takes trained people to do that. But it doesn't take very many people to grow an enormous amount of food. And we feel, and we've constantly been working on optimizing that process, and have really, in fact, in the last year and a half, we've kind of, I would say it's about a 320% increase in our yields just over that time period through improving the medium and some of the culture techniques we use.
Which in turn increases your capacity for shellfish seed production at the same
Correct.
Time.
Correct.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah, I'm ready for some New England style algae IPA. It'd be delicious. It'd be perfect.
Yeah, right.
And we know, Scott, that when Bill walks into a room and he sees a guy in Tevlek suit cleaning up that tank, he's looking. He's keeping an eye on that guy.
He's got a card in his pocket, just in case.
That's a succession plan right there.
Right.
So, Bill, these are fantastic eating. We all have been to a raw bar. We know the quality. We know these are, your crop is a direct result of the ecology and the environment of these animals growing. But oysters also represent so much about their surroundings, the environment. They filter water. They're restoring keystone marine ecosystems. They're building protective reefs and so much more. Can you tell us why you believe oysters are so important to the stability of our seas and our planet?
Well, for a lot of nearshore areas, they're a keystone species. The big thing about oysters, as you alluded to early on in the show, that they're filter feeders. So they are cleaning the water, creating more clear conditions for more penetration of light. They tend to provide conditions that favor the good types of other marine microalgae. They provide they're also removing excess nitrogen from the water and making their tissues out of it. So there's just a lot of ecological services like that crops like oysters do for the environment.
You've been involved in a couple initiatives with other oyster growers on trying to formulate a cohesive movement with looking at how oysters can impact coastal communities.
Well, so the I think what you're referring to is a program. It's called the Shellfish Growers Climate Coalition, mm-hmm. And that was born out of a frustration that I had. Over a number of years, where we were identifying and beginning to see some of these impacts of climate change on our businesses that were already really costing us. And everybody's probably by now heard of ocean acidification. That was sort of the alarm clock going off for us. But in addition to that, we have seen more and more frequent intense rain events. In Maine, every time there's a rain event with 2 inches of rain in 24 hours, the state closes down the growing areas to shellfish harvesting. And usually those closures can last either several days to as much as a week while the state goes out and tests the water to test the bacteria to make sure that the water, that the shellfish are still going to be safe to eat. Those are sales that you don't get back. So those are that was kind of realizing that these costs were there and we were beginning to talk about them, but not having any real plan as an industry to tackle the root cause of all these problems, which ultimately are greenhouse gases. Hmm. So the idea with the Shellfish Growers Climate Coalition, which is we come under the umbrella of the Nature Conservancy, we realized as shellfish growers that we did not have the means and the time to establish this organization on our own. We sought a larger nonprofit that had the resources and the infrastructure and the people to help us pull this together, and that would be able to direct the members of the coalition to help in their efforts to to tackle and promote policies for clean energy. And so basically the idea was to get as many shellfish farms as we can to start this thing and sign on and create basically kind of an endorsement coalition. But the idea is, and we're in the early phases. It's only been going on for less than a year. I think we're now up over 50 members, 50 to 60 members. But the ultimate idea is to get this so that it extends beyond just shellfish farming, and it extends to other food sector industries, for example, craft beer, distilleries, you know, row crop farms, and any food production industry that is has a story to tell about impacts of climate change. So that's really the idea behind that. Hmm. And I think it's exciting. What our role is as shellfish farmers is we can tell our fellow citizens that climate change is a real thing and that it is already costing us and that it is an urgent problem that needs our attention.
And if they'd like to continue eating oysters and pairing it with those local craft beers and all of the local wineries that have popped up around the region, then they should get behind it. And at least it makes it even more tangible, you know, for them to have that product right in front of them rather than trying to, you know, get them to learn more about water chemistry and water quality issues that are pretty amorphous.
Yeah, that is exactly the point. You nailed it.
So, Bill, let me pull one of those threads here and ask about ocean acidification. Why does it affect us? What changing the pH of the ocean, why does it affect us? And then the second part of that is, what does it do to the oysters?
So the ocean acidification is not something that directly impacts humans. It's an indirect effect, and it is through all creatures that make their shells out of calcium carbonate. Those are sort of the first types of animals that are impacted by this. There may well be other, and the reason for that is that clams, oysters, scallops all make their shells out of calcium carbonate, and as more carbon dioxide dissolves into the ocean, that forms carbonic acid that brings down the pH, meaning that the water is becoming more acidic. There's already been a 30% decrease or increase in acidity since the Industrial Revolution. And this is a process that is just, it's only going to continue until greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide emissions are curbed. So we have a lot of work to do to make that happen. But if we don't start bringing people's attention to that now and get the process going, then I think we run the risk of confronting a real big tipping point where we start losing some of the things that we value and will need in the future as sources of food.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Scott also mentioned with that, people lack to realize that our oceans, our healthy oceans, and maybe we're looking at shellfish as a bit of a canary in the coal mines here of
exactly.
acidification, but this healthy system of where the current pH levels are keeping good thriving ecosystems also sinks a third of the total carbon that we put in the environment spewing through our day-to-day actions.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Mm-hmm.
And so if we don't have that, we've got some significant problems on where that's going to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I going back to the food, the looming food crisis, most experts believe that aquaculture is going to play a crucial role in meeting the needs of the planet when there are 9 billion people on it. And so, we have to take care of the oceans mm-hmm. if we're going to be able to cope with that.
And for products like oysters or other farm-raised shellfish, for that matter, with the exception of perhaps the emerging sea greens or sea vegetable farm-raised industry that's coming along here in the U.S., it's among the only, if not the only, extractive form of agriculture. So by that I mean you're not having to put anything into the water.
That's
so that,
right.
That environmental benefit, where it's changing, the ultimate assemblage in some of these little coastal areas and the estuaries that are so important for the spawning habitat of so many different fish species. That it has direct impact down the road on just what ends up on the plate. So not just the oysters, but the fish and everything else that's related to those.
That's absolutely true. And I think the scary thing about ocean acidification is that we don't really know all the ecological ramifications of adding all this carbon dioxide to the water and lowering the pH. There's a lot more at stake than just the shellfish, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. One thing I would just mention, because I think it's going back to the looming food crisis again, is that, you know, mussels are a wonderful, sustainable product. Oysters are too, don't get me wrong, because I've spent my life growing them. But, oysters, as we know, are a fairly high-priced, a little bit more of a white table restaurant fare than mussels, which also are white table fare, but also more accessible to everybody to buy. And there's a huge potential for growing mussels in our marine waters. Mm-hmm. They're basically also filter feeders, filtering a lot of water, and they improve water quality and are a great source of protein.
Hmm. And I think one of the most underrated shellfish products that's out there today.
I agree.
It has been interesting to see to that point of decommoditizing food, where oysters, to your point, Bill, we now look at things like terroir and marroir, where they're from, who's growing them. We have interest and intrigue of this. Mussels maybe a little further down, but even mussels earned a moniker of Prince Edward Island, or Irish mussels, which have
right.
a elevated standard at market. Boy, with Maine having 3,500 miles of coastline and actually having the capacity of working these bonds, it seems like this could be an epicenter for growing out our future of regenerative ocean farming. Are you seeing your compatriots up there looking at it in a similar way?
Absolutely. I think people are really thinking hard about all of that. And I believe that mussels are going to be a really important future crop here in Maine. That with the caveat that I do think there needs to be, some work at dealing with this whole greenhouse gas problem. However, that one thing that is related to that is the seaweed component. And as you mentioned before, that is one crop that is not necessarily impacted or possibly even impacted positively by having more carbon dioxide, because as a plant, they're taking carbon dioxide out of the water. And there is a fair amount of research going on around the country that's beginning to show that you can have these halo effects where you're growing seaweed in proximity with mussels. So, and you do see mussels doing, substantial or, certainly significant amounts of growth during the winter months when those crops are primarily being grown. So, in fact, there's a researcher at Bigelow Labs who recently, through some work that they've done, showed that the mussel shells are thicker where they were grown in proximity to a kelp farm.
I'm curious, Bill. I'll share one of my pet peeves with you that I think is still plagues development of the marine aquaculture industry here in the U.S., in that it's never where is it best for aquaculture, but where nothing else wants to be.
No, and yours and my pet peeve. Yes.
So, but I'm curious. It sounds like, based on the transition that you're seeing with commercial fishing folks and the industries that support commercial fishing folks, as well as coastal and inland residents who want to eat more of these products, that there's a bit of a transition underway where they're starting to look at aquaculture development in more of a positive and proactive response rather than just where nothing else wants to be.
Yeah, I think that's true. But if you look at the Maine leasing statutes, it's essentially, when you look at the criteria that have to be satisfied in order for the state to grant an aquaculture lease, it's essentially exactly what you just said. You mm-hmm. can't, there can be basically nothing else going on there of significance mm-hmm. in order for them to grant you a lease. We have not made the transition to looking at food production at a broader level or a higher altitude and saying, okay, this is a really important thing for the future of food production. Where are the areas that we need to target? Where is it going to be best for growing mussels? What mm-hmm. what are those sites? Mm-hmm. And taking that kind of an approach and the economic development aspect of it.
Right.
Bill, what can we expect to see from Mook Sea Farms? Are we going to see continued progress with oysters? Are we going to see other shellfish like mussels, like scallops come into play? What's your five-year horizon here?
So all of the above. As I mentioned, we are working really hard to create this other product that we're going to be selling, which would be the microalgae. One of the things that we're doing is we're moving our existing clean room out of our hatchery, which is down here by the Damariscotta River, into the new building, which is back inland a little bit. And we're using that space that's vacated by the algae system to be able to diversify and grow some other species. So we are real interested in sea scallops. We've actually done sea scallops before. We would consider growing bay scallops, surf clams, we're going to be looking at a lot of things. And the idea is that we can do some pilot scale projects where we work on not only the hatchery part of the technology, but also coming up with different, hopefully innovative ways to grow them to market size. So we really, you know, part of our whole plan for being resilient is to diversify in those ways.
Exciting. Lots of opportunity.
Lots of opportunity, yes.
And Bill, where can a listening audience learn more about Mook Sea Farms? Where can they enjoy some of these Mookie blues?
Well, you can go to our website, which is mookseafarm.com. And I think you can also get there from maineoyster.com. You can eat Mookie blues all day long at Row 34 down in Boston. Mm-hmm. There are a number of places in New York City. Another place you can have our oysters in New York, for any New Yorkers who might listen to this, would be to go down to the Lobster Place in Chelsea Market. They have our oysters. So those are a couple places.
Fantastic.
That is fantastic. Scott, final thoughts?
I just think was a reflection of the conversation we've had, that there is, as I mentioned, I think lots of opportunity, you know, not only what, you know, Bill referenced and, you know, his experience over, you know, 3+ decades, but even my more limited experience here in Massachusetts and what we're seeing for growth in the industry and looking at aquatic production for shellfish and other aquatic species, other species that we maybe haven't even tried to cultivate yet. As a real opportunity, not only for our palates, but I think more importantly for the environment at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I'll just add that as I sit back, kick my feet up, and enjoy some Mookie blues and wash it down with some New England style algae IPA, maybe even a couple of Domino sugar cubes, I'll sit back and think, wow, I'm really saving the environment here. Pat myself on the back.
Let's get over to Row 34.
That's right. We'll have a post-conversation meetup. Bill, I can't thank you enough for partaking in today's conversation. I learned a great deal. I'm sure our listening audience will as well. Scott, thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure. Great talking with you, Bill.
And great talking with both of you. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Bill. Take care.
Take care. So long.